Last week, I invited you to consider the idea that sometimes floats through UU circles, that in addition to our seven principles and our six sources that we print each week on the back of your orders of service, we should perhaps add a seventh source, our UU history and heritage. While continuing to seek wisdom wherever we can find it, from all the world's religions, from modern science, from our own direct experience, we should also recognize our tradition's homegrown resources. The roots of our Unitarian heritage, that half of our heritage, go back more than five centuries to the 1500s in Europe. And the Universalist half of our heritage goes back to the 1700s, right here in North America. Along these lines, last Sunday, we reflected on the life of that innovative minister-scientist, Joseph Priestley, who, in addition to discovering oxygen and inspiring the Jefferson Bible, also helped spread Unitarianism in our region. Priestley died in 1804 at the age of 70, so he lived most of his life in the 18th century. So this week, I'll be inviting you to shift your focus up to the next generation, to the 19th century, with William Ellery Channing. Next week, we'll shift our focus away from history for a few weeks, so for any non-history buffs out there, relief is coming. And then in mid-March, we will again briefly revisit our UU history and heritage. I want to do a few sermons about the Transcendentalist revolt within Unitarian Universalism that came the generation after Channing. But for now, let's turn our attention to Channing's legacy. I first heard of Unitarian Universalism in college, and our student group was named the Channing Circle. You may also have noticed that our chapel, if you look at the plaque outside, it is named the Channing Chapel. Some of you may have had the same reaction to our Channing Chapel that I had to our Channing student group, and that was, who is that guy? Less transparently, some of our oldest, largest, and most venerable UU congregations also owe their name to Channing. All Souls Unitarian, right here in D.C. How many of you have been to an All Souls Unitarian? There's a few different ones, so quite a few of you. So there's All Souls Unitarian here in D.C. There's also All Souls, the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. Both of those are close to 1,000 members each, as well as the 1,800-member All Souls Unitarian in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's right, the largest UU congregation in the world is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places. So all three of those All Souls UU congregations owe their name to a famous passage from William Ellery Channing in which he said, "I am a living member of the great family of all souls." He felt a deep spiritual connection to all human beings. He continued, "I cannot improve or suffer myself without diffusing good or evil around me through an ever-enlarging sphere." That sounds a lot like a 19th century version of Dr. King's famous passage that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, that we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Or the words of our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence. What Channing meant and what inspired those UU congregations to take on that name, All Souls, is that all of us, despite all our diversity, are part of the same human family. Here in the 21st century, many would extend that sense of connection beyond even just our human family to all beings. Accordingly, how we treat ourselves and how we treat others matters. Laura spoke a little bit about that in the children's story. And it ripples out, either increasing or decreasing, the amount of compassion and cruelty in the world. That's what it means to be connected in this great family of all souls. Choosing kindness matters. Or again, in Channing's words, I cannot improve or suffer myself. And I kind of hear a little Buddhism there. I can't create suffering for myself like we sometimes do. So I cannot improve or suffer myself without diffusing good or evil around me through ever-enlarging spheres. We are connected in that great family of all souls. And to begin to tell you a little more about the author of that phrase, the namesake of our chapel, William Ellery Channing was born in 1780 and died at age 62 in 1842. To set him a little bit in context, keep in mind that Ralph Waldo Emerson, his breakout book Nature, was published in 1836, so Emerson was just getting started at the end of Channing's life. But Channing loomed large for Emerson. Emerson called him, and this really says something given the anti-authoritarian, anti-institutionalism of a lot of Unitarianism. Emerson called Channing our bishop, showing the great esteem that Emerson held him in and the leadership that Channing had within our movement. Emerson wrote further that Dr. Channing, whilst he lived, was the star of the American church, and we thought then, if we do not still think, that he left no successor in the pulpit. One among many reasons that Channing continues to be an important figure for us to consider today is that whereas Emerson famously left his Unitarian pulpit after a short time to go on the lecture circuit, and whereas other UU ministers got caught up in like utopian dreams like Brook Farm in Massachusetts, these utopian communities, George Ripley is one, they left their Unitarian pulpits, Channing stayed for almost four decades at Federal Street Church in Boston. It's now known as the Arlington Street Church. He was 23 when Federal Street ordained him and installed him, and he was the minister there until he died at 62. If you're interested in learning more about Channing, perhaps the best starting place is a biography of him by Jack Mendelsohn, who is actually one of his successors in the Arlington Street pulpit. Mendelsohn subtitled his biography, Channing, the Reluctant Radical. Channing's a really interesting figure. If you're a person who has kind of moderate tendencies, that was Channing, and you can kind of look back and see how he tried to live that out. And you can see it was finally in the last decade of his life that he finally began speaking out against slavery, but he held out hope that we might be able to end slavery by choosing the right thing, he hoped to escape violence, and that, of course, was not the case. But he did finally, in the last decade of his life, begin speaking out increasingly and writing about against slavery, that great moral evil of his time. And although Channing is not always remembered today, Mendelsohn writes that in 1880, the 100th anniversary of Channing's birth, elaborate public celebrations sprang up not just in the United States, but throughout Great Britain, Ireland, and Europe. Enthusiastic tributes flowed from Asia. He was truly known worldwide in his day. The minister at the time of that Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City said of Channing, "We do not say that he was, but that he still is." He was still very much alive for them. "He is a burning and shining light, and the season has not even reached its meridian when the church and the world are willing to rejoice in his light." Now, perhaps surprisingly, given his influence, Channing stood at only about 5 feet tall. He was about 100 pounds, and he was sickly and weak most of his life. Along these lines, I mentioned last week that one of the most powerful recurring themes in UU history is of people born into conservative theological congregations who then begin reading the scriptures for themselves, learning more about the history of the tradition, and then having the courage of conscience to stand up and say, this doesn't stand up to reason and experience, and then liberating themselves. And Channing was certainly part of that tradition. But he was also part of another more disturbing trend in UU history. And Theodore Parker, who we'll talk about in March, who was also the author of the song the choir will sing for the offertory, both Channing and Parker and others ruined their health through overwork. That's another dangerous trend that you see in our history. Channing had an almost monk-like ascetic side and pushed himself far too hard as a young minister. He would regularly stay up for hours past midnight, reading by candlelight, often until 4 a.m. He often slept on the hard floor without blankets. Now, he had a bed, but he wanted, was kind of choosing this austere way. And he did not eat enough, leaving himself frequently malnourished. So using today's medical insights, one educated guess is that he ruined his adrenal glands and that's why he was weak and sickly the rest of his life, because of the anxiety, the stress, and the exhaustion that he put himself through. Really unnecessarily, he did it to himself. The cautionary tale here is perhaps similar to the sermon I preached in January on Thrive and choosing a year of well-being about Arianna Huffington, the founder of the Huffington Post, her wake-up call when she passed out and hit her cheek on the corner of her desk, almost really injured her eye. And when she got a bunch of medical tests, they said, "Arianna, the only thing wrong with you is sheer sleep deprivation," and that she was just overworking. So being famous and successful, or even having the potential to be, will not protect you from neglecting self-care. Eating well, exercising, meditating, getting adequate rest and vacation is vitally important for all of us. We're now a month into the new year. Has 2015 been a year of well-being for you so far? If not, this piece of Channing's life, and the reason that he died at 62, he likely would have lived longer if he hadn't sacrificed his health. What that might be an invitation for you to reevaluate how might you give yourself permission to do those things that might make this year of well-being for you, to take care of yourself for the long run. Another reason I wanted to share with you about Channing is that we're rapidly approaching, unbelievably, 2019. I can't believe it's already 2015, but May 5th, 2019 will be the 200th anniversary of Channing delivering what may be the most significant, well-known, and influential sermon in Unitarian history. A sermon that he delivered at the ordination of the new Unitarian minister of the congregation we now call First Unitarian Baltimore, Maryland. So perhaps in addition to planning a pilgrimage to tour Joseph Priestley's house, which is about 2.5 hours from here in Northumberland, Pennsylvania, we may plan that for the fall. I want to increase your awareness of the significance of Channing's Baltimore sermon as we approach that 200th anniversary, and you'll start hearing talks about commemoration. You can also get ready for the year after that. In 2020 will be the 250th anniversary of John Murray's first Universalist sermon in the U.S. But returning to our focus for today, I mentioned earlier that our Unitarian roots go back to the 1500s in Europe. But it's important not to project our contemporary UU values onto our ancestors. The implications of anti-Trinitarianism and introducing reason and experience, this sort of theologically liberal way of being religious, that evolved over time. And it took centuries for us to reach the robust religious pluralism that we celebrate today. But reflecting on our history can make us grateful that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and it can be an invitation to reflect on what might we be called to do today that others might stand in turn on our shoulders and advance the frontiers of justice and peace and religious liberalism. So for an example from our past, although some of our ancestors, like Faustus Socinus in the 1500s and Joseph Priestley in the 1700s, did explicitly teach that Jesus was fully human just like the rest of us, probably the preponderance, though, most of our ancestors did not think that until maybe the 20th century, which is when humanism really got started in Unitarian, mainly in Unitarianism. So take, for example, William Ellery Channing. While rejecting the Trinity as unscriptural and irrational, he still continued to think that both Jesus and Christianity were unique, special, superior. Consider this passage from Channing. Jesus Christ is more than a man, existed before the world, literally came from heaven to save our race, still acts for our benefit, and is our intercessor with the Father. So still using, you know, very much patriarchal language, very much kind of traditional Christian doctrine. Moreover, in the early 19th century, Unitarianism was not a label that many of our forebears used. They saw themselves rather as just open-minded, congregationalist Christians. Unitarian at that time was actually a negative epithet, that what their opponents focused on was them being anti-Trinitarian. So they're like, you're Unitarian, that's the most significant thing about you and the most horrifying thing to them about you. But the reason Channing and others didn't want to claim that title Unitarian is that they didn't think that was the most interesting thing about them. They just preferred to just not talk about the Trinity. That just wasn't what they were interested in. So they resisted this label, Unitarian, being hurled upon them. Rather, to them, what was most important was teaching that the divine is love, as opposed to those Orthodox and Calvinist notions that God is about judgment and fear. Channing also did another famous sermon called The Moral Argument Against Calvinism, because he thought that teaching that those views that God is all about fear and judgment, that he's like, aren't we supposed to be, you know, we're lesser than God, so doesn't that make... He found it morally repugnant to teach that that's who God was, because he said, we're supposed to be like God, so why would we want to be all judgmental and fearful? So he brought a moral argument against Calvinism. So they said, what's significant about us is not rejecting the Trinity. What's significant is that we teach that the divine is love. What's significant about us is that we teach that not predestination, we teach that everyone has free will and can and that we have tremendous potential for goodness and to choose the good. That's what's significant about us. And that we teach that you should emulate Jesus' teachings and ethics, not get into fights about what you believe about him. So that's one of the reasons people resisted that that title, Unitarianism. But finally, in 1819, Channing had enough. And when he had this occasion to preach at the sermon in Baltimore, which was considered the South, so he said, you know, this is a chance to be out of New England. And he said, I'm going to claim and own that term, Unitarian, and define it for myself. So he preached a sermon called Unitarian Christianity. And to give you a point of comparison, my sermons are generally about 2,000 words and take about 20 minutes to deliver. That sermon was 7 times longer. It was 14,000 words and took about 90 minutes to deliver. But of course, they didn't have TV and the internet back then, so there was less competition for for things to do on your Sunday. Channing's Baltimore sermon became a sensation. It was quickly published, and no pamphlet save Thomas Paine's Common Sense had ever before circulated so widely in this country. So people were really reading this. They wanted this alternative view to Calvinism and to orthodoxy. Keep in mind as well that about the boldness of taking this risk. This was 1819. This is 200 years, almost 200 years ago, decades before the Civil War, decades before Darwin, you know, published on the origins of the species. So this was pretty bold. Channing was saying very explicit things like, the Bible is a book written by humans, in the language of humans, and its meaning should be sought in the same way as other books. This Baltimore sermon helped galvanize theologically liberal ministers, a process that continued 6 years later in 1825, when a gathering of like-minded ministers came to the basement of that Channing's church, the Federal Street Church, and decided to form the American Unitarian Association, that in turn, more than a century later, merged with the Universalist Church of America in 1961 to form the Unitarian Universalist Association. So Channing was pivotal in all of that, with claiming the title Unitarian and getting individuals to do it, and then to organize around it. As we continue to reflect on Channing's legacy for us today, a legacy of beginning to organize around the term Unitarian, a legacy of the consequences of overwork, and which can be to us a reminder to practice self-care, a legacy of remembering that we are each a living member of an interconnected family of all souls, I invite you to hear once more a version of those famous words that you heard, which you read together earlier, which was from, I think, 1837. Channing was asked to address the Sunday school board. So he said, I want to talk about the great end of religious instruction, because of course religious education is a foundational core piece of what we do and the reason we exist as a congregation. So in our life here as a religious community that's part of that legacy that Channing helped found, may your mind be stirred up. We don't want you to check your brain at the door of the church. We want to bring the best of your whole self here. May your mind be stirred up and quickened and strengthened with the power of thought. May you learn to trust what you see. Don't think that you just have to rely on secondhand knowledge and what people tell you to be the case. May you learn to trust what you see when you look at the world inquiringly and steadily with your own eyes. May you be inspired with a fervent love of truth. May you find time and space for stillness, that you might look inside yourself to touch inward springs. May your conscience, your moral discernment, be awakened, that you might look with impartial, conscientious judgment at whatever subjects may be offered to your examination. And when you feel those tugs at your conscience, that still, small voice inside you, may you have the courage, as Channing and others did, to speak out and say, this isn't right. It doesn't have to be this way. And may your soul be woken up, that together we might cherish an authentic spiritual life. May it be so for us and for generations to come. Continuing to reflect on the legacy of Channing and others, I invite you to rise in body or spirit, to turn in your hymnals to 113, and you'll hear as we sing this hymn the same sort of thing that Channing and others were doing. You'll hear this redefinition of traditional religion, this questioning of where is our holy church, and you'll hear the hymn reinterpreting that word. Where is our holy writ, our holy one, our holy land, our paradise? As we sing, listen to that traditional terms reinterpreted through the lens of religious liberalism. coming along this morning. We're going to get out of here early. So let me tell you something. I got a little more I can tell you about Channing. So it'll be brief. So I mentioned that Channing's Baltimore sermon was in 1819, and that was the sort of midpoint of what was known as the Unitarian controversy, and that started in 1805, and what triggered it is that a Harvard professor, I think, died, and so they had, or he resigned or died, and so they had to replace him, and he was replaced not with a Calvinist, but with someone who was liberal theologically. And so the Calvinists started getting upset. They're like, they're going to make Harvard liberal. And it turns out, you know, it's not paranoid if they really are after you. So they were right. Harvard did become theologically liberal. And that the person appointed to that was Henry Ware Jr. So when you hear sometimes, like Martin Luther King Jr. gave what is known as the Ware Lecture. There's a very venerable lectureship at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly every year. And Martin Luther King gave it. Cornel West will give it this year. That's the same Ware that started the Unitarian controversy back in 1805. And he was appointed to what is known as the Hollis Chair of Divinity, and that connects to today, because if some of you have heard of Harvey Cox, he's retired now, but he taught at Harvard. He wrote a famous book called Religion in the Secular Age, kind of talking about the secularization thesis. Or Karen King, some of you may have heard her name, teaches at Harvard. If you heard about that little manuscript that she provocatively titled The Gospel of Jesus' Wife, that got a bunch of headlines about a year or so ago. So both Harvey Cox and now Karen King are the Hollis Chair of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School. That's the same Hollis Chair of Divinity that back in 1805 Henry Ware Jr. was appointed to, that started the Unitarian controversy, that eventually compelled Channing to say, fine, we're Unitarians, we'll just own the name, but define it for ourselves. And that's what that 14,000-word sermon was about defining Unitarianism on their terms, not on theirs, as saying we're so much more than about the rejection of the Trinity. That's really of no consequence to us. That was not interesting to him. What he wanted to say was what we're about, which was a religion of action, a religion of love, and about deeds, not creeds. So as you continue to go from this place, continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.